Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Now I'd like to introduce our second speaker. It really gives me great honor to introduce Barnett Rubin, who is the Director of Studies and a Senior Fellow at the Center for International Cooperation at New York University. I think it is probably enough to simply say that Dr. Rubin is considered one of the world's foremost experts on Afghanistan, as well as on conflict prevention and on peace building. Welcome, and thank you for coming this afternoon.
Thank you. Is this on? Okay. I just wanted to note that when I was a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, one of the issues we had to confront was whether we were for peace or not. And we finally decided that we were of peace and not for peace. That would be not objective enough. And similarly, the place I work now is the Center on International Cooperation, not for international cooperation. We try to leave it an open question, although often one does come up with similar answers. Making a constitution is really the preeminent kind of process of building a nation. And I say building a nation because a lot of the things that are sometimes called nation building actually should go by some other name, in particular state building, which I will come back to. But drafting and agreeing on a constitution really is the activity of building a nation, because it provides the basic rules through which a set of individuals gain rights through their participation in a common political community and how they choose to be governed together, which is what makes them into a nation politically. A nation cannot effectively govern itself, however, without a state, because the state, the mechanism of administration, legitimate authority, is the institution through which the nation implements its decisions. And part of the real challenge of Afghanistan is that it is a country where, to some extent, the process of making a nation has gotten ahead of the process of making a state. And that is just the most abstract way of saying that it is one thing to reach agreement about a text, and it is another to make it into a real institutionalized system for living together. Now, if I can just, in this context of this process of nation building, just give you some brief impressions first about the Loi Jirga, which I attended for the first 2 weeks or so of its sessions, and then had to come back before the final crisis and denouement. In the discussions I had with my international colleagues before the Loi Jirga, whatever our views of the draft constitution were, which varied to some extent, I would say the main preoccupation that most of us had was that the Loi Jirga should not make it worse. We thought really that, and partly this was based on the experience of the emergency Loi Jirga, where some leaders were able to use Islamic slogans and symbols demagogically to intimidate people into agreeing to certain things. We thought that no one would be able to stand against such demagoguery if it was practiced, that it was unlikely in such an environment to get things that were more liberal or egalitarian, in particular with respect to women, through, and so on. And I must say that we were wrong. There were a significant number of changes made to the draft in the course of the constitutional Loi Jirga. Some of them moved the Constitution in ways that the international community found somewhat problematic. But the vast majority of them, I think, are considered by both Afghans and by internationals to be positive. So purely in terms of what it did for the document, it was a positive experience. But I think more than that was the political experience of the constitutional Loi Jirga. And here, of course, there is a lot of political fallout from the Loi Jirga, There are divisions within the cabinet. There are bruised feelings. There are exacerbated factional feelings. The reason for that is that for the first time that I know of in the history of Afghanistan, a really representative group of the representatives of all the groups of the country, including 20% women, which is a higher proportion of women than in the United States Congress, met. And when I say representative, I don't mean to say they were democratically representative. They were not. But despite all the reports, many of which are accurate, of intimidation and some kinds of fraud in the elections, I can say that there's not a single political viewpoint about Afghanistan, with the possible exception of open espousal of the dictatorship of the proletariat, that I have heard propounded in the past 25 years that I did not hear propounded at this Lai Jirga by someone or other, even if not in exact proportion to the prevalence of those opinions in the population. And no one has been injured yet as a result of that. And all the most important issues in the life of that nation, including some extremely sensitive and difficult ethnic and religious issues, were openly and explicitly discussed. Now, normally, in my experience, those issues were kind of openly and explicitly discussed in private groups of like-minded people. And in public, they were usually discussed through the use of coded language by calling members of other groups communists or fanatics or something of that nature. And I won't say that, of course, that went on too. But these issues were actually discussed. Ethnicity was not discussed solely in terms of you sold out the country by being allied with a foreign power. It was discussed in terms of what language will we use for administration and for education, which is a genuine ethnic issue that involves the real interests of people. It was discussed in terms of what system of representation and exercise of authority will we use that will structure the relationship of the state to the various groups that compose the country. And that was really and seriously discussed. You may be, I was amazed, and I was discussing it with Ambassador Jawad over lunch. He was also amazed, and some of our discussions, well, I'll just tell you the story he told me. He was having lunch with some Baluch delegate from southwest Afghanistan, which is about as far as what we usually think of from what we usually think of as centers of civilization as it could be, although at one time, if you see the ruins in that area, it was in fact itself a center of civilization. And he started asking him questions, and the guy said, well, we have to go back to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is the Bonn Agreement. And then he started talking about the structure of the Bonn Agreement. And this is, you know, Baluch nomad from southwest Afghanistan. So people are quite informed and politicized. I don't know where they get this information, actually. It can't all be from the BBC. But there were some very illuminating discussions. Now, let me talk about what some of those issues were and how they... I'm not watching my time, so I hope someone else is. I'll try to be brief, especially since we got here late and we want to have discussion. I would say first, just background, well, 2 points. One is, I'm going to talk about some issues that are kind of domestic political issues in Afghanistan. Now, why would I don't think all of you are like experts on Afghanistan or Southwest Asia, and your interest in this is not because of your academic interest. Why is this of interest to U.S. foreign policy? It's of interest to U.S. foreign policy because the threat, even if we take the kind of narrowest core definition of U.S. interests, and I believe in a much broader definition, but of security, the United States was attacked by people who exploited the lack of legitimate political authority in Afghanistan to establish a center for the worldwide coordination of illegal activity, namely, in this case, terrorism, funded by other illegal activities such as smuggling, drug trafficking, and so on, as well as donations. And the only sustainable way to prevent that from happening again is to help Afghans construct a state in that territory. Given that, you know, we're not in the business of rejoining borders, and you know, which is useless anyway, because then they'll just have a different set of wars. It's to help Afghans create a state through which they can provide themselves with security, legitimately, and thereby also provide the rest of us with security. So working with them to help them establish such a state that can be sustainable, which means that it has to have a legitimate base, and there has to be a kind of political community of the nation that can support the existence of that state, turns out to be a core foreign policy interest of the United States. And that's why some somewhat obscure things I will talk about are nonetheless relevant in this building. In the history of Afghanistan, Afghanistan was an empire before it was a state. It was a political structure that was established through the conquest of a coalition of tribes led by Pashtun tribes, who conquered other areas, and they taxed non-Pashtuns more heavily than Pashtuns, to just put it in the simplest form, and other territories outside of what is today Afghanistan as well at times. And the state was controlled by a Pashtun dynasty, different Pashtun dynasties. They didn't conceive of it. I mean, it wasn't really ethnic politics because there wasn't ethnic politics. It was, you know, more like tribal or family politics. But as the state developed and ethnic identities developed, it became perceived in that way as well. And just to put it very simply in this short talk, question in Afghanistan is the state an instrument through which a Pashtun political elite rules over this territory and the peoples living in it, you know, giving them certain rights and so on, or is the state a mechanism through which all the people living there govern themselves as equal citizens of the state? Now, there are countries that we all consider to be democracies in the world today that have both models, because there are countries that officially give one nation, as they call it, the status of constituent nation. So even though it's very different from the U.S. model, neither one or the other is a foregone conclusion, and that doesn't necessarily have to be officially recognized. But this is an issue that was underlying a lot of the debates in the Constitution, in the Lloyd Jirga. First, system of government, which was the major issue. Now, first, Afghanistan has had constitutions in the past, depending on how you count them, because there were some pseudo-constitutions or illegitimate constitutions. Let's say there were about five real constitutions, counting Najibullah's last constitution. But this is the first constitution Afghanistan ever had, where it was not predetermined automatically in advance who the ruler would be and what the system of government would be. Because for the first four constitutions, you knew you were going to have a monarchy, and the king decided what kind of monarchy, and then you had somebody draft something, and then you had a Lloyd Jirga. Then you had a communist constitution, which was similar in political structure. In this case, it wasn't 100% open, but it was an open question, and it was debated. And in a way, finally the two polls that emerged were presidential and parliamentary. Now, scholars of those two systems have different views about why one is better than the other, and mostly scholars support parliamentary system because it's more governable, it's easier to pass legislation, and so on. But that actually is assuming the existence of a state and assuming the existence of a number of other things. Now, this played out in two ways. One is ethnically, in that in the Lloyd Jirga, the Pashtuns there, and the Lloyd Jirga saw a kind of reemergence of Pashtuns, were a fairly solid bloc in support of presidential system. In the belief among some of them, not all, everyone doesn't agree, that this would be the mechanism for creating a strong central power where the president currently is a Pashtun and is likely to be Pashtun in the future. Representatives from other groups in the country, whom some stigmatize as warlords, and there were also some warlords' particular interest in this as well, but it also represents some legitimate ethnic claims, favored a parliamentary system on the grounds that that would create a coalition government with representatives of different parts of the country. Now, the argument actually, what I found is there's an interesting argument that didn't get into the Constitution, but maybe will have an effect in the future, which is Afghanistan needs, and this was a number of the supporters of the presidential system, including a number of members of the cabinet who are very close to the president, said to me, actually, a parliamentary system would be better government for Afghanistan once we had a government. But right now, if you tried to create a government based on a parliamentary system, we wouldn't have a government, because the parliamentary elections would be controlled by warlords and drug traffickers. There are no political parties. You'd have 15 factions. They wouldn't be able to agree on anything. So it would mean that the attempts that there would be no center of authority that could lead the attempts to construct the things that we heard about before, the National Army, the National Police, and administration, reconstruction, and so on. There wouldn't be a coherent partner for the international community to work with. And therefore, we need a presidential system now to create that kind of focus of power, but that maybe in the future we want to move toward a more parliamentary system. There were some such discussions. There's no mechanism other than the normal amendment mechanism in the Constitution. Now, I'll rather than go into that, let me just mention briefly a couple other issues, which we can touch on in greater detail. Decentralization of the government. It reaffirms that Afghanistan is a centralized unitary state, as Ambassador Jawad said, but it also contains very brief provisions for creation of councils. Whether those will be implemented will depend on a lot of things. Generally speaking, again, many people I spoke to said we need a strong we need to centralize now because what we have now is not not having a government is not the same thing as having a decentralized government. That is legitimate authorities based on their control of weapons is not the same as a decentralized government. So first we need to create a legitimate government through construction of a center. Then we can think about decentralizing later. The language issue was very important and very interesting, and it was multi-leveled because, on the one hand, Pashto was not given a special status as the national language as it was in previous constitutions, but it retained a special status in a limited way by being the language of the national anthem, but at the same time, that unilingual national anthem is required to mention all the ethnic groups in the country. Then there are two official languages, Pashto and Dari, which is Persian, as spoken in Afghanistan. And as Ambassador Jawad said, the recognition of local languages, which was originally a demand of the primarily Uzbek and Turkoman delegates, which is the first time that Turkey languages and a number of others have been recognized in Afghanistan as well. Obviously, implementing that will be very difficult. Another related issue was the recognition of Shia jurisprudence for the first time in Afghanistan, which was given an almost parallel status with the Hanafi Sunni jurisprudence, which was a demand of the Hazara community, which is also, and I might note that the integration of Hazaras and of the Shia into the political structure of Afghanistan, including the central government, which exists now, is unprecedented in the history of the country and is a kind of undiscussed success, actually, in national integration. Islam, this was a surprise for people because there were actually open discussions of the question of Islam in the meeting. Article 2 was changed in two different ways. There was a whole package. Actually, you'd have to, for me to describe this, there's a whole package of articles that were kind of negotiated in private together, and they were approved as a package. One is that there are some things that were made more Islamic, like Article 3, no law can be contrary to beliefs and provisions of Islam rather than just Islam, and where it says later down that the state will fight against the production and consumption of intoxicants, that is alcohol, as well as drugs and so on. On the other hand, the protection of non-Muslims was strengthened very significantly by saying not just that they're free to perform their ceremonies, but that they're free to exercise their faith, which is a much broader category. Part of this deal was there's no qualification on Afghanistan's responsibility to uphold international covenants. There is no, the legal equality of women is explicitly recognized in Article 22, and there are a few other things like that as well. So this is a kind of package deal. And in fact, in the discussions in the working groups, which are about 50 people, a number of which were presided over by Islamist jihadi personalities, which is what Malalai Joya was protesting about in her speech. Nonetheless, people got up and openly argued against them, and they actually lost they lost most of the time. Certainly that happened in Sayaf's group. You know, in a way, people were afraid they would intimidate people, which is what had happened at the previous Lai Jaga, but I didn't really see it happening here. I mean, no doubt, some people said they were intimidated, so people felt intimidated, there was some intimidation, but they weren't silenced. Everybody was not silenced, and in fact, they did not get their way on many issues. They did get their way on some, and some of us may not be happy about that, but on the other hand, I think to some extent the outcome is a genuine representation of some kind of balance of beliefs, not necessarily, not democratic, but some kind of genuine representation of where the balance falls in Afghanistan as of today. I'll just say one very negative thing in the Constitution, in my view, is the something that wasn't discussed, which is the judiciary. And that is that the judiciary is organized in Afghanistan in a way that, to my mind, confuses the concept of judicial independence with the concept of judicial non-accountability. Because the judiciary is a self-enclosed, self-perpetuating caste, in that the Supreme Court is not only the Supreme Court, but it is the administrative head of the judiciary. It appoints the lower court judges. The president has to confirm them, but the president has never refused to confirm any of those appointments. The judiciary actually is one of the parts of the state that operates least with the least respect of the law. They're an illegal number of people on the Supreme Court. It issues decisions on things that no one has asked it to issue decisions on. And in fact, members of the Constitutional Commission said in private that the current system creates corrupt networks of judges. Nonetheless, they chose not to change it. And the fact that they not only did not change it, but left it in the Constitution means that judicial reform will be more difficult in the future than had they at least left out those things. And there are many other things as well. Bear in mind, and here's my final point, I think, given time constraints, and this will have, I know you said it was a relief not to talk about Iraq. I'm just going to say something about Iraq. I think, possibly some relevant point for Iraq. It was very difficult to draft and reach an agreement on the Constitution under the current conditions in Afghanistan, because people felt they could not speak freely under conditions of continuing conflict and intimidation, and that also affected the way that the whole process was planned. One of the reasons that it wasn't a very open process from the beginning, with all the difficult issues put on the table immediately, was because of the fear on the part of those who were organizing the process that that would lead to hijacking of the process by those with the power to intimidate. Then that would make it less representative. And most important is we don't know what Afghanistan will be like in 5 years. I mentioned before a number of the most important institutional choices were made on the basis of the way the country is now. That is, the lack of political parties, the lack of a stable administration, lack of security, and the type of institutional or political structure that you need for state building may not be exactly the same political structure that you will want later for governance. Right now, maybe the main problem is creating some kind of stable focus of authority. Later, you may be more concerned about inclusion and participation. And those are things that I won't say they're in contradiction, but they can be in tension with each other. And therefore, it is not always a good idea to lock something away as a constitution, to make something as difficult to change as a constitution when the situation is in such great flux. And I know some of us who are at Bonn now feel that perhaps we should not have suggested putting in the process, making a constitution only 2 years into the process, because maybe you need a more kind of flexible basic law that can be changed more easily in 5 years or something like that when the situation changes. There are some post-conflict constitutions that contain mechanisms for a review of the Constitution after a period of time. And in the discussions we had with the Constitutional Commission and with Ambassador Jawad when he was in the President's office, we did discuss those, but I think people were concerned that, in a sense, putting something like that in the text of the Constitution calls the makes people feel that maybe the rest of the it's not really a constitution, so they didn't want to undermine it. But I will note that in his final speech to the Lai Jirga, President Karzai did say that the Constitution is not the Holy Quran, and it can be changed if conditions change through another Lai Jirga, which is part of the procedure for amending the Constitution, which the Constitution has within it. The next step, of course, steps for implementing the Constitution, and constitutional implementation is the most difficult, one of the most difficult parts of having a Constitution, which has been unfortunately neglected, will involve, of course, the holding of elections, drafting of a lot of secondary legislation, creating new institutions, and so on, and we may want to discuss those, but I will conclude with that for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.